The consular dinner that evening was formal. There were a dozen guests, all that remained of the diplomatic corps and the civil administrators of the Khedive in Cairo. As usual, Rebecca was her father's hostess. David had sent an invitation to Ryder Courtney without consulting either Rebecca or Saffron, either of whom would surely have exercised a veto if they had had the chance. Ryder had been cherishing a young buffalo heifer in the expectations of selling it for an enormous profit when the city was relieved. The prospect of salvation was becoming daily more remote, and the buffalo had a voracious appetite that was increasingly difficult to satisfy. When he received David's invitation, he slaughtered the animal and sent a haunch with two bottles of cognac to the consular kitchens. Rebecca recognized the gift as a peace offering, and it placed her in a terrible quandary. Could she refuse it, when it would make the evening a triumphant success? It would mean acknowledging Ryder's existence, which she was not yet prepared to do. She solved the dilemma by sending him a note delivered by Amber, accepting the gift on behalf of her father. She knew this was weakness on her part, but she salved her conscience by determining not to address a single word to him if he attended the dinner. Ryder, as was his wont, was the last guest to arrive. He was looking so elegant in his dinner jacket, and seemed so at ease with himself and the world, that Rebecca's anger was exacerbated. Nazira lied, she thought, as she watched from the corner of her eye, as he chatted affably with her father and Consul Leblanc. He isn't suffering in the least. At that moment she became aware that she, in her turn, was being watched. She glanced round sharply to see Captain Ballantyne studying her from across the room, with the knowing smile that had begun to infuriate her. "He's always spying," she thought. Before she recovered her poise and looked away, she noticed that his hair and his whiskers had grown out in a rather fetching fashion. She felt her cheeks burn and that disconcerting sensation in her lower belly. She turned to Imran Pasha, the former governor of Khartoum, who was now subservient to General Gordon. 10 minutes later she glanced around surreptitiously to see whether Captain Ballantyne was still spying on her, and felt a twinge of annoyance when she saw that he was engrossed with the twins, or they were with him. Both Amber and Saffron were shrieking with laughter in a most unladylike fashion. She regretted that she had given in to their blandishments and allowed them to join the company instead of making them eat their dinner with Nazira in the kitchen. She had scored a small point by seating Saffron beside Ryder Courtney. The child would have difficulty holding firm to her vow never to speak to him again. She had placed Captain Ballantyne as far away from herself as possible, at her father's end of the table. The buffalo haunch was a glorious pink in the centre and running with juices. The company fell upon it in ravenous silence. No sooner were the plates removed than Captain Ballantyne whispered a few words to her father, stood up, bowed to her, and strode from the room. She knew better than to expect an explanation for his departure. After all, they were at war, and he was responsible for the city's defences. However, she regretted that she was to be deprived of the opportunity to snub him more profoundly. She glanced down the table at the second object of her disapproval, and saw that Saffron had obviously forgiven Ryder. At the beginning of the meal he had ignored her haughtiness, and had concentrated all his attention on Amber at his right hand. This had brought Saffron close to tears of jealousy. Then he had switched tactics and turned all his charm on her. She'd been unprepared for this. "Saffron, did you know that Lucy has had her babies?" Before she realized the trap, she was listening avidly as he told her Lucy had given birth to twins. What the babies looked like, how proud Lucy was of them. He had named them Billy and Lily. "Oh, can I come and see them tomorrow? Oh, please, Ryder!" Saffron cried. "But, Safi, Nazira told me you were not feeling well," Ryder said. "That was yesterday. I was feeling rather peaky." Ryder gathered that peaky was one of her new words. "But I'm very well now. Amber and I will be with you at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning." The trial of wills had ended with a complete capitulation on her part. Rebecca made a small mow at the silliness of the child and turned her attention back to Consul Leblanc. She had overheard her father remark to Ryder that he was as queer as a duck with four legs. It was a pity that she was unable to ask Ryder what that meant. It sounded intriguing, and Ryder knew everything. I suppose I will have to forgive him in time, she thought, but not just yet. The dessert was pate of green cake with warm honey sauce. At David Benbrook's instigation, Bakshit had robbed the nest that wild bees had built in the palace roof. He had been sternly restricted to the removal of a single honeycomb. David had a sweet tooth and was hoarding the bees' output. This dish was also warmly received, and the Limoges porcelain dessert bowls were scraped clean. "I have not enjoyed a meal as much since my last visit to Le Grand Vefort in 81, Leblanc assured Rebecca. "Despite his four legs, he is rather a dear old ass," she thought. In this new mood of benevolence, she glanced back at Ryder, caught his eye, then nodded and smiled. His obvious relief was really quite gratifying. "Am I becoming fast?" she questioned herself. She was not certain what being fast entailed, but her father disapproved of fast women, or said he did. After their guests had departed, and they had climbed the spiral staircase to the bedroom floor, her father placed his arm round her shoulders, hugged her, and told her how proud he was of her, and what a lovely woman she was growing into. "So he does not think I am becoming fast," Rebecca thought, but nevertheless she felt strangely discontented. As she prepared for bed, she whispered, "There's something missing. Why should I feel so unhappy? Life is so short. Perhaps the Mahdi will storm the city tomorrow, and it will all be over, and I won't even have lived." As if the monster had heard her and stirred in his lair, there came the crash of artillery fire from across the Nile. She heard a shell shriek overhead, then burst somewhere in the native quarter near the canal. With her hair in a golden cloud upon her shoulders, she threw on her silk dressing gown, turned the lamp down low, and opened the door to the balcony. She hesitated, feeling guilty and uncertain. "There won't be anybody there," she told herself firmly. "It's after midnight. If he's still awake, he'll be at the waterfront with those Gatlings." She stepped out onto the balcony, and before she could stop herself, she glanced down and searched beneath the outspread branches of the tamarind tree. She felt a nasty twinge of disappointment when she realized she had guessed right. Nobody was there. She sighed, leant her elbows on the wall and stared out across the river. "The Bedlam Bedouin is having an early night," she thought. Since sunset there had been only that single cannon shot, and now all was silent. In the moonlight she watched the bats diving and circling as they hunted insects in the top branches of the ficus tree at the bottom of the terrace. After a few minutes she sighed again and straightened up. "I'm not sleepy, but it's late. I should go to bed," she thought. A vesta flared in the shadows beneath the tamarind tree, and her heart tripped. The flame settled to a yellow glow, and she saw his face lit like the portrait in a cameo, while the rest of him remained shrouded in darkness. He had a long black cigar between his teeth. He placed the tip of it to the match and drew deeply. The flame burned up brightly. "Oh, sweet Jesus, he's so beautiful." The blasphemy was out before she could quell it. Still holding the burning match in front of his face, he looked up at her. She stared back. He was 50 yards away, but she was mesmerized, like a bird by a cobra. He blew out the vesta, and the image of his face was gone. Only the glow of his cigar remained, brighter, then fading as he drew on it. The pain came over her again, pervasive and debilitating, until she no longer had control of her emotions. Like a woman in a trance, she turned slowly, went back through her bedroom and out into the corridor beyond. She passed the door to her father's suite, and her bare feet danced faster over the silken carpet that led her to the head of the staircase. She ran down and was suddenly stricken with the fear that he would be gone by the time she reached the terrace. She fumbled with the latch of the front doors. It seemed an eternity before they opened. She ran across the lawn, then stopped dead when she saw his dark shape exactly where it had been. He took the cigar from his mouth, dropped it onto the stone flags, and waited. Her feet moved again of their own accord, slowly at first, then faster. I won't, she stammered. Don't talk, he commanded. And she was overwhelmed by deep gratitude, although she did not understand why. She went into his arms, which closed round her. She lost all contact with reality. His mouth tasted of cigar smoke mingled with precious musk, a distillation of masculine ambergris, a rare elixir of desire. She felt terrified and helpless, yet as safe and secure as though she had been spirited into the keep of a fairy fortress. Her silk robe and the light cotton nightgown offered no obstacle to him. Her skin beneath them was burning hot, but his cunning fingers ignited deeper and more intense fires within her. She closed her eyes, threw back her head, and surrendered to his touch. Suddenly she gasped, and her eyes flew open at a sensation almost too exquisite to be borne. The painful knot in the pit of her stomach burst, and a new, wonderful sensation replaced it and diffused through her whole being. She looked down and realized that the front of her gown was open to her navel, and his mouth was pressed to her breast. She could feel his teeth upon her nipple, and thought he might bite through to her very heart. He picked her up, and she felt weightless. He laid her on the lawn, and the grass felt cool and soft under her back. He lifted the skirts of her robe, and the night air caressed her thighs and belly. She felt his weight come over the top of her. He was touching her where she had never been touched before. Her thighs fell apart. The cannon across the river roared. She heard the shriek of the approaching shell, and her legs snapped together like the blades of a pair of scissors. The shell flew so close overhead that it took her breath away, so that she could not scream. It crashed into the east wing of the palace and burst in a cloud of flame, dust, flying plaster and bricks. With all her strength, she thrust him away and rolled out from under him. She jumped up and, long pale legs flashing, ran like a fawn startled from its forest bed, back across the terrace and up the stairs. Frantically, she raced to the twins' room beside her father's suite. The door was never locked. She ran into them, gathered them up and held them tight. She was sobbing with relief to find them safe and for her own escape. "Are you all right, my darlings? Oh, dear Jesus! Thank you for keeping us all safe." She hugged them closer, but the twins were sleepy and grumpy. "Why did you wake us up?" demanded Saffron. "What's wrong with you, Becky? Why are you crying?" Amber yawned and rubbed her eyes. "Why are you being so silly?" Before she could reply, her father came in through the door, carrying a lantern. "Are you girls all right?"
"What happened? What is all the fuss about?" Saffron clamoured.
"Didn't even wake you up, what?" David laughed. "The Bedlam Bedouin will be mortified. He's been shooting at the palace for months. The first time he manages to hit it, you go on sleeping as though nothing has happened. Shows a lack of respect, I'd say."
"Oh, was it a shell?" Amber said. "I thought it was a dream." "Where, Daddy? Where did it hit?"
"The east wing, but it's deserted. Nobody hurt, no fires. Everything's safe." The twins were asleep before Rebecca left them, but after she got back to her own bed, she could not drop off. She tried a prayer. "Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, thank you for looking after Papa and the twins. Thank you for saving me from—" She did not think it necessary to elaborate. He knew everything. "For saving me from a fate worse than death." She had read that expression somewhere, and now seemed an appropriate time to use it. "Please keep me from temptation." But the prayer did not seem to help. She did not truly feel as though she had been saved. On the contrary, she felt as though she had been cruelly deprived of something of great value, something as dear as life itself. She thought about how he had touched her, and began to ache again where his fingers had been. Timidly she ran her own hand down to make sure he had not hurt her. She started with panic as she felt that she was bleeding, all hot and running wet. She pulled away her hand and held it up to the moonlight, streaming in through the window. Her fingers were indeed damp, but not with blood. She replaced her hand and felt the pain swelling up inside her. She was panting.
and wicked images flashed before her tightly shut eyelids. Penrod Ballantyne standing over her, naked, with the knife in his hand. She imagined his fingers where hers were now. The huge ball inside her exploded, and the pain was gone. She felt a wonderful sense of elation and freedom. She felt herself falling backwards through the mattress, sinking down into a warm, dark nest of sleep. When Nazira woke her, sunlight was streaming in through the open balcony door. "What happened to you, Becky? You are glowing like a ripe peach on the bough with the morning sun upon it."
"Arabic is such a romantic language," Rebecca thought. "It suits my mood perfectly. Darling Nazira, I feel as though this is the very first morning of my life," she replied, in the same language, and wondered why Nazira suddenly looked so worried.